On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, I would like to turn your call over now to Annie Beigel.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to welcome you to today's conference call, How Tobacco Companies Get and Keep Your Patients Hooked. And our featured speaker, Dr. Michael Cummings, Chairman of the Department of Health Behavior, Roswell Park Cancer Institute. As healthcare clinicians, many of you do not hear about the tobacco industry's manipulative marketing tactics and may not fully understand how powerful they are in driving people to smoke cigarettes. And, you know, many of us ask the question, why in this day and age do people smoke when we all know how deadly it is? Why? And part of the answer to this question is going to be covered in today's presentation. Yeah. The collaborative work group thought it would be important for healthcare clinicians to know and understand the influences that entice patients to smoke. And so as you listen to this presentation, please remember your role in making a difference. The research is in, and we know that when you ask your patients if they smoke, advise them to quit, and then assist them by talking with them and providing pharmacological support, that you can double and even triple the quit rates of your patients. And on today's call, we're happy to be offering continuing education credit for respiratory therapists. And before we begin, I have some CME logistics that I need to cover. The faculty disclosure statement, Ciccatelli Associates Incorporated is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This activity is accredited for a maximum of one APRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. The ACCME requires that faculty participating in a CME activity disclose to the audience any relationship with a pharmaceutical or medical equipment company which might pose a conflict of interest. Dr. Cummings is on the Speakers Bureau of Pfizer, the makers of Chantix, is a consultant of Novartis, is a paid expert witness for plaintiffs in litigation against the tobacco industry, and has received research support and grants from the New York State Smokers Quit Line, Erie Niagara Tobacco Free Coalition, and the Western New York Tobacco Cessation Center. There are no commercial supporters of this activity. And now to obtain continuing education credits, please complete the verification of attendance and evaluation form sent by email and also are available on the New York State Smokers Quit Line quit site. In fact, all completed forms to Ciccatelli Associates within 2 weeks of the program to receive your credit. Certificates will be mailed out in 6 to 8 weeks. And now, it's my pleasure to hand the call over to Pat Bax, Marketing Coordinator with the New York State Smokers Quit Line. She's got some great news to tell us all, and then we'll get started with our featured speaker, Dr. Cummings. Pat, you want to let everybody know?
Yes, thank you, Annie, and Happy New Year to all our participants on the call today. This is truly an exciting time at the Quit Line as we are celebrating surpassing our 1 millionth call to the Quit Line since our inception back in the year 2000. On behalf of the Quit Line staff, thank you for your crucial role in helping us to reach this milestone and to help us save lives across our state. We encourage you to continue using our services with your patients and your clients as we assist our next 1 million calls to the Quit Line. If you do have questions regarding our services, please call us directly at 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487. It is now my privilege and honor to introduce our featured presenter for today, Dr. Michael Cummings, who is also the director of the New York State Smokers Quit Line. Dr. Cummings is widely recognized as one of the leading public health scholars in the field of tobacco control, and I invite you to read his bio and vitae that is posted on our website, the Quit Line website, to learn more about his accomplishments. Dr. Cummings has most recently been recognized for his outstanding research contribution, as he is the recipient of the prestigious American Cancer Society's 2009 Luther L. Terry Award. Thank you, Dr. Cummings, for sharing your valuable time and expertise with us today. We look forward to an inspiring presentation.
Thank you, Pat and Annie, and welcome everybody, and Happy New Year. This is an exciting time. If you got a chance to read the New York Times piece yesterday talking about the reinvigorated effort at the federal level to perhaps finally take on the tobacco industry. And one of the areas that they talked about in that article is the concept of regulating tobacco products. The objectives for today's talk, and I'll move right to that slide, I think it's your third slide that you have, really are two for this presentation today, and I'm going to try to leave some time at the end for questions. And for those of you who are following along, there's a PDF version of the slides. There's also a larger PowerPoint, which may take a few moments to download if you have trouble downloading it because computer doesn't take it very well. You can send me an email afterwards and I'll be happy to send you a link or, if necessary, a CD so you can have the slides and perhaps use them for presentations that you might be doing to patients or to the public or school children or whatever. The objectives for today's call really are to help you recognize a little bit about how tobacco product design influences people's smoking behavior and how you can incorporate that information even into the counseling that you might do with patients. We're always, you know, we all know that we need to ask all our patients whether they use tobacco, what type of tobacco they use, how long they use, because that tells us a lot about their risk status and so on. Of course, we advise our patients to quit smoking. We offer assistance. But I wonder how many of us actually ask our patients what brand of cigarettes they might use. And the advantage of doing that, in really less than 30 seconds, you get probably millions, billions of dollars worth of psychographic information on your patient right there that the tobacco companies have been spending a lot of money gathering, because the brand of cigarettes or the brand of smokeless tobacco that somebody might use will tell you a lot about perhaps their motivation for using tobacco, whether they're thinking about quitting, whether they have misperceptions about light cigarettes and so on. So you'll learn a little bit about tobacco product design today, how it influences the behavior of your patients, and hopefully you can incorporate that information into your counseling efforts or public education efforts down the line. Even New York State, I'm told, in the next few months will begin its efforts through its media campaigns to try to educate public not only about the risks of smoking but also about nicotine and the difference between dirty and clean nicotine, the dirty form coming in the form of tobacco products and the clean form in the form of medications. So we move to the next slide, the one on marketing. The key to marketing is to know your target audience and to shape your product and product advertising to meet the needs, wants, and desires of the population that you're targeting. This is what a marketer does. And the next slide really just talks about the four P's of marketing, which is how a marketer will really configure their efforts to try to design products, price them in a way that will make them accessible to their target population, put them in places where they can be distributed and easily obtained, and then how they go about communicating information to their target audience or promoting it. So we're going to focus today on product, what you're selling, and specifically tobacco products. So the next slide really just, you know, highlights one of the things that I've learned in the last 10 years going over tobacco documents, millions of them that are now online, and they tell you a lot about how tobacco companies have effectively marketed their products to get people hooked and to keep them hooked. And tobacco documents revealed that there's really nothing in the tobacco product that has been left to chance by the tobacco industry. In other words, everything is very carefully researched. And, of course, they need to know their target audience. So if we go to the next slide, that's just a telling you the typical smoker today. And, you know, taking a line from Sarah Palin, I was, you know, linking here to Joe Sixpack, because that's the typical smoker we have in New York today. It's not a college graduate. Smokes a little less than a pack a day. The average number of cigarettes smoked today is about 16 cigarettes. Typically buys by the pack at gas stations or convenience or grocery stores. Is very brand loyal, although price will determine switching behavior. So the most popular brands today are Marlboro, Newport, and believe it or not, Doral. Doral is a discount brand. Smoking increasingly is limited to isolated spaces such as the car, home, and outside at work on breaks because of the clean indoor air law that we have here in New York. Smokers tend to be sports fans. They watch a lot of TV. They don't read a lot in the newspapers. They go out to clubs and bars more than non-smokers. They have higher average consumption of alcoholic beverages, higher reported rates of mental illness, as we know. And most have tried to quit in the past, and most say they want to quit and expect to do so in the near future. So that sort of gives you the basics of who a typical smoker is here in New York. Now, there are three target groups, as illustrated on the next slide, that I'll be talking about and how the industry has marketed to these three groups. The first group is referred to as the worried well. The second one is the contemplator. That's the individual who is maybe getting around to the point, you know, maybe they didn't make their New Year's resolution of quitting on January 1st, but they've got it in their mind that maybe they should quit, or they see those ads that are running on TV now highlighting the health effects of smoking. And then, of course, the group that's most critical to the industry are youth, because they've got to replace the many people who do quit or otherwise die from smoking every day. So those are the three key target groups from the industry. So the first group, target group number one, the worried well, is shown on the next slide. We'll start with the basics of the four Ps, how the industry designs products for this target group, how they price those products, where they place them, and how they go about promoting them. So let's go back and do a little history lesson as shown on the next slide. This is just an article from the Journal of the American Medical Association from Dr. Winder and Graham. It was one of the first papers published in the United States in 1950 that talked about the link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And this got back in the 1950s, of course, about half of all doctors were smokers, so this was sort of startling news, but it was really beginning of the health scare information that began to come out in the medical journals that the industry eventually reacted to. In fact, if you go to the next slide, this is an ad that appeared in 1951 for L&M cigarettes. This is just what the doctor ordered, a filtered cigarette that's going to solve your problems. Of course, in the 1950s, most cigarettes did not have a filter. If you go to the next slide, this is another example, this one from 1952. You can see the proof of Kent's health protection, the Kent Micronite filter. The next slide tells you about the Micronite filter, which, by the way, was advertised in leading medical journals of the day, as well as newspapers and magazines. And it mentioned that the Micronite filter was made of pure dust-free material that's so safe, so effective, it's been selected to help filter the air in hospital operating rooms. And of course, some of you have heard me speak in the past know that the Micronite filter was made out of chrysotillite asbestos. So this was actually a cigarette design trying to build off of the health information that was beginning to come out at that time and the concern that the cigarette companies had to redesign their products to address the worried well, and who better to address first were doctors, by the way. So this particular ad for Kent cigarettes showed up in medical journals. They also sent Lorillard Tobacco, the manufacturer of Kent, sent three packs of Kent cigarettes to all physicians who were part of the American Medical Association back in 1952 as part of their promotion. And it worked pretty well. If you go to the next slide, you can see, you know, the industry's response. Here we go. More scientists and educators, the worried well out there, while they smoke the Micronite filter. It went from about 1% of cigarette sales being filtered cigarettes. Almost all cigarettes in 1950 were of the unfiltered variety. And by the end of the decade, by 1960, over half of all cigarettes sold were filtered cigarettes. And today, of course, about 98% of cigarettes sold are filtered cigarettes, even though there's no good evidence that the filter, in fact, makes cigarettes safer. The filter is made out of cellulose acetate. If you go to the next slide, it just gives you the constituents of a cigarette filter, cellulose acetate, which is nothing more than photographic film. The inventor of the cellulose acetate filter, which is the typical filter used on virtually all U.S. cigarettes, was Kodak. They made a lot of film long ago before the digital camera, and still today the leading supplier of cellulose acetate tow, the basic material used in cigarette filters today, is a company called Eastman Tennessee. They're the supplier along with one other company. Film, by the way, is translucent or clear, and it's a fancy way of saying you can see through it. But cigarette filters, of course, are look white. They have a white appearance, and that is because of the white filter or titanium dioxide that's painted on the material, which is essentially the same stuff they use in sneakers to give it its white appearance. In other words, white shoe polish. If you go to the next slide, you can all say this five times fast. You know, filter fiber fallout. Because there's a little defect in the filter that the companies began to learn about 45 years ago, which is that the little tiny fibers, about 12,000 in every cigarette butt, which are sort of woven together, actually fall out of the filter. And if you put a cigarette into your mouth and I were to come by with some scotch tape and touch it to your tongue, some of those fibers would appear right on the scotch tape if I look under a microscope. These tiny microscopic fibers, of course, when you're inhaling deeply to get the nicotine that smokers are desiring from their cigarettes, and you have to puff a little harder with a filter than one without a filter, and so smokers puffed harder. They suck these little fibers down into their lungs, and you can see a picture of a filter fiber coated with the tar in that particular ad, sucked into the lungs, where it doesn't biodegrade. This is essentially plastic, now coated with a carcinogenic tar, providing concentrated doses of the tar. So while it reduced some of the tar that you would get in a machine, it actually introduced the smoker to a new risk that most smokers have no clue about. Most smokers tell me they would never smoke an unfiltered cigarette under the false perception that it's somehow safer. So if you go to the next slide, things were all smooth sailing for the tobacco companies. By January 11th, 1964, of course, we had the Luther Terry issued First Surgeon General's report. And there's the committee there at the press conference. And this is what they said in the next slide in that press report and in the original 64 Surgeon General's report. It said that cigarette smoking is causally related to lung cancer in men and that the magnitude of effect far outweighs other factors. And the data for women, though less extensive, is pointing in the same direction. If you go to the next slide, of course, the industry denied this. This is actually a consumer letter that was sent by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company to a consumer who had written to them really soon after that report was issued in January. Here's the letter from February 26, 1964. And what they said is there's nothing new in that Surgeon General's report, nothing that has not been heard before. The fact remains that the cause of cancer in human beings is unknown. So that's what the industry position was in 1964 and was until actually they changed that position in October of 2000. So for almost 45 years after the Surgeon General's report, they held to this particular view. If you go to the next slide, you find that meanwhile back in tobacco land, you know, they were figuring out how to redesign their products. Not to make them safer, not to reduce the tar, not to eliminate the filter fiber fallout that Philip Morris knew about back then, but instead to give smokers a psychological crutch and a self-rationale to continue to smoke. That meant really a design solution. If you go to the next slide, it's interesting to note that Carlton, which was the first filter-vented cigarette where they put little vent holes in the filter, allowing the smoker to draw air in addition to the hot smoke, therefore cooling it, giving you the illusion that it is a little lighter in feel, was introduced actually 5 days before the release of the Surgeon General's report. And of course, Brown and Williamson did this because they knew what was going to be in that report. They knew that it would create a large group of worried well smokers out there who were looking for a solution to cigarettes. Of course, the solution to smoking is to quit, not to be going to a light cigarette, particularly one with air vents. If you go to the next slide, this basically highlights the fact that a variety of the products that have been introduced over the years, like low-tar Merit cigarettes and some of the other low-yield cigarettes that have been introduced, were utilized a variety of techniques to try to reduce the tar yield. with a smoky machine. So they used filtration to start with, filter vents I just mentioned. They also use porous paper, so they create paper that has a little bit more air ventilation in it that's wrapped around the rod of tobacco. They began using reconstituted tobacco, which is another way of saying most of the tobacco, or a good share of the tobacco in cigarettes today, is not even real tobacco. It's remade. So the tobacco that's recycled, the ones that the packs that aren't sold go back to the factory and reused again. And they also used expanded tobacco. This is tobacco that's puffed up like puffed wheat to fill up the rod so they don't have to put as much tobacco in, all designed to give low yields on a smoking machine. Now, if you go to the next slide, I'm going to spend a little time talking about filter ventilation, because this is probably the biggest fraud, and it is the fraud of lights. It's probably the most influential design feature of the modern cigarette. And all it involves is, this is a picture here showing the tipping paper that wraps around the cigarette filter, and you can see these tiny vent holes. And it's hard to see these, actually, with the naked eye on a cigarette, because they're designed to sort of blend into the filter white on white, so you can't see them very easily. And basically, most smokers have no clue that there are vents in their cigarette filter. But what happens is, if you go to the next slide, the filter ventilation allows ambient air to flow into the filter during puffing. This dilutes the smoke with air, reducing the concentration per puff. It also increases the temperature at the burning end of the cone, because you're introducing oxygen into the mixture, which gives you a different mix of combustibles, or what they call, it's a fancy name for tar, pyrolysis byproducts. That's just the stuff that's generated when you burn the paper and the tobacco. The problem is it makes the tobacco, mixing it with oxygen, more mutagenic. So if you do what sometimes you may have heard of an Ames assay that's sometimes used to evaluate cosmetics and various food products for the DNA damage it may cause, and the Ames assay has been correlated with the risk of a substance being carcinogenic, or a likelihood of it causing cancer. And it turns out, like the tar from a light cigarette or a cigarette that's more heavily ventilated, is more mutagenic. In other words, it scores higher on this Ames assay. This is something the cigarette companies knew about in the 1960s, but never told anybody about. And it was revealed in some of the lawsuits that came forward on the light cigarettes in the late 90s and early 2000. The cigarette testing machine, if you go to the next slide, was the real marketing vehicle that the industry utilized to market light cigarettes. It made the assumption that smokers were all going to smoke the same way, puffing 35 millimeter puffs, two puffs every 60 seconds or so, and up to maybe 8 to 12 puffs depending on the length of the cigarette. And so we developed this rating scheme of high tar, medium tar, and low tar, or ultralights. And in fact, this is what you see. The little pads there on the right are referred to as Cambridge pads, and they represent the tar, particulate matter, that gets trapped on the little Cambridge filters. Now, the problem with this is people don't smoke like a machine, and the introduction of filter vents actually allow people to take bigger puffs, deeper puffs, and in fact, defeat the benefit of lowering any of the tobacco that might be in the column, so they actually are smoking for nicotine. So essentially, people get the same color if they were all rated as how they smoke rather than on a standard machine. The standard machine was recently dropped, by the way, by the Federal Trade Commission, which had set up this system in the late 60s, but because it no longer accurately assesses people's smoking behavior, it's no longer used. This is showing you the flaw, the next slide, the flaw in the cigarette machine. You can see the filter vents there not being blocked in any way when you put it into a smoking machine, so it allows the air to dilute it, giving you the illusion that you're getting a lighter product. If you go to the next slide, this is the cheating the system. Over 30 years, it looks like the tar and nicotine and carbon monoxide yields of cigarettes decline. This is what it shows on a machine. But the problem was it didn't decline whatsoever if you were to actually measure the amount of tar, carbon monoxide, and nicotine that smokers actually get into their body. So the next slide just highlights the design feature again and the defects of filter ventilation. It's deceptive because smokers aren't even aware of it. Companies use it to market the low tar as if you're getting less tar, less nicotine. And it's defective because actually the smokers may get more dangerous tar because it's actually more mutagenic. Smokers can compensate for reduced yields products. Ventilation promotes taking larger puffs, and ventilation holes can be blocked. Now, with ultralight cigarettes, they don't sell very well. Those are the very low-yield ones, like the Now and the Carltons, which are under 1 or 2 milligrams of tar. They don't sell well because smokers find that they can't even compensate by taking huge puffs. They actually have to smoke more cigarettes, and because cigarettes cost money, people smoke fewer of them. So that's why the market share of the super ultralight cigarettes, the less than 2 milligram tar products, is less than 1% of the U.S. market. When they talk about ultralights today, most people are talking about a Marlboro ultralight, which is about a 6 milligram tar cigarette, and that's one that people can compensate on quite nicely. The next slide actually gives you a way of educating your patients about the filter vents. So, as I said, only about 1 out of 5 smokers is even aware that their cigarettes have filter vents, even though about 90% of cigarettes sold in the U.S. today are vented. So smokers are not aware that their cigarettes are vented. You can take the tipping paper off, as is shown here. I do it with a little paper clip here. And if you take off that little strip of paper that rolls over the filter tip, you need to get a flashlight because the vent holes are so tiny. But if you hold up the filter vents under a flashlight, you can see they'll appear magically and will show you that, you know, how many vents are in your filter. If you go to the next slide, this is just from a trade publication for out of a tobacco journal. From a company that makes cigarette filters. And they say we can make them, you know, with tip ventilation that's visible or invisible. And I don't think it's a surprise that the cigarette companies all have chosen the invisible variety. They could make it very apparent to smokers, so they wouldn't necessarily block them when they put them in their mouth or hold them in their fingers. But the cigarette companies, in fact, have chosen to make them invisible, so most smokers are not aware. If you go to the next slide, how do you sell a brand called Controversy? Because let's face it, after 1964, I think people began to learn that cigarettes were dangerous, so the cigarette companies had to come up with some new clever ways to market their products. So if you go to the next slide, one of the ways they did this, of course, was deceptive marketing. And this particular slide is actually from the Leo Burnett Company. It shows the introduction of Marlboro cigarettes in 1971. Marlboro Red, which everyone has known, you know, knows about that, you know, traditional red chevron that you see on the Marlboro pack, and you can see the Marlboro man there with the cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He's got the rope up in the air. A lot of action in that slide. Well, they introduced Marlboro Lights on the left in 1971. You can see the chevron is a different color, golden rather than red, a little smaller. And the cowboy has a little less action. He's just holding the rope. He's not actually, you know, having the thing up over his head. This is all carefully researched marketing to actually reinforce to the consumer that the product is giving you less. Less of whatever you want. Less nicotine, less tar, less cancer, less heart disease. That was the deception that was introduced there. If you go to the next slide, of course, you know, they have products like, with all the talk about smoking, I've decided to either quit or smoke True. I smoke True. This was a Lorillard product introduced in the 1970s to try to, capture a share of that worried well market and really going right after the notion of delaying quitting. And a lot of smokers, unfortunately, assume that they can switch to a light product under the belief they get less nicotine and therefore it should be easier to quit. This is false. People get the same amount of nicotine in a light cigarette as they get in a regular cigarette. Makes no difference in terms of your quitting, except it probably just delays doing it. Carlton cigarettes in 1980, if you go to the next slide, an egregious ad where they said 10 packs of Carlton have less than tar than one pack of all these other cigarettes that are listed there. This is completely false and bogus. The Carlton filter was actually designed as a collapsible filter, so when you put it in your mouth, the little vents that they had built in to beat the smoking machine would collapse on top of each other, and people got a concentrated dose of tar and nicotine. In fact, it was so egregious that some of the other tobacco companies, Philip Morris and Reynolds, complained to the Federal Trade Commission that Brown and Williamson was cheating the system, although they all cheated. Of course, the next slide just highlights the fact that smokers have been misled about this. And many smokers still to this day believe that you have to smoke more cigarettes that are lighter to get the equivalent amount of tar you get from a conventional high-tar cigarette. And this is just not true. So you can see an example of an ad that we've used here in Buffalo to educate the public, you know, which of these is the fraud. These are all, by the way, Philip Morris or Altria products. They make Crystal Light and Cool Whip and so on. They also make Marlboro Lights. And number two, of course, is the fraud, because while these other products give you less calories, the Marlboro product does not give you less of anything. If you go to the next slide, as I've mentioned, many smokers believe that switching to a light cigarette will help them cut back, and this is not true. And this is what we need to really communicate to smokers. When we've done surveys throughout New York to ask people about methods used to quit, it's sad to see that many people do mention switching to a light cigarette as a method for quitting, and that's just it's an ineffective and fraudulent method for trying to quit, because it won't help you quit because you don't get less nicotine. Now, the next series of slides really just highlight from a study that we've done the misperceptions that smokers have about full-flavored and light cigarettes. And I've used this is a study that was actually done by a colleague of mine in Canada. So you can see the lovely Canadian graphic warnings. We should have these hopefully soon here in the United States. You can see the one on the left is a full-flavored Kent, and the one on the right is a light. So smokers in a shopping mall were asked, basically they were given the two packs, and they were asked the following questions. Tell me which one delivers less tar, smoother taste, and a lower health risk. And you can see consistently the majority of people believe the light gives you less tar, smoother taste, and a lower health risk. This is not true. So these are misperceptions. If you go to the next slide, we did the same analysis, but this time we gave people packs of cigarettes that just varied in the color of the pack, in this case going from a darker blue to a slightly lighter blue. And you can see the same misperceptions occurring. And if you go to the next slide, we even did one where we showed a swish that is colored in with gray versus one left white. And you can see there is, in fact, the perception of just using the coloring of the little symbol on the pack makes a difference in how people perceive the products as delivering less tar, smoother taste, and lower health risk. The answer, of course, is no difference. Well, unfortunately, the cigarette companies, if you go to the next slide, were enormously successful in shifting the public initially from filtered to unfiltered, and from 1964 up until the present, they've had great success switching people over to what is referred to as lower tar, under 15 milligrams of tar, even though it makes absolutely no difference. You know, imagine what would have happened if these same smokers have, instead of switching, had just been told the truth about smoking and the cigarette design and quit. We'd have a lot fewer lung cancers and heart disease today. Now, in the 1990s, the cigarette companies had to deal with, as shown in my next slide, smelly, smoky cigarettes as people got sensitized to the dangers of secondhand smoke. If you go to the next slide, you can see their introduction of Eclipse cigarettes. This is a cigarette that they hoped wouldn't be regulated by the tobacco companies. They introduced it as a cigarette. It really isn't a cigarette. It's a heating device to deliver nicotine. As you go to the next slide, you know, you might get a little less secondhand smoke, but the Eclipse cigarette actually delivers glass. It uses glass, a little carbon tip, a real Rube Goldberg type of device, hardly a cigarette because you're just heating that little carbon tip. It heats up nicotine that's embedded in some of the tobacco, and you get a nicotine vapor out the other end of this thing along with a little glass. not too healthy for you, but, you know, showing you the industry's effort to try to market a low-smoke cigarette. Next slide. And now we have online, you know, shocking e-smokes. And you can actually go to a website, tobaccoproducts.org. Don't go to .com or you'll be buying cigarettes, but if you go to tobaccoproducts.org, we have a basically a registry. It's a Wikipedia site that we put up information on a variety of new products, the flavored products, smokeless products, as well as some of these electronic e-smoke cigarettes that are now beginning to show up on various websites. And, of course, our friends from Philip Morris has introduced their Accord cigarettes, shown in the lower right there. And they've been marketing this as in bars as a way to try to circumvent clean indoor air laws. This one, this particular marketing campaign was from Switzerland. If you go to the next slide, we'll move on to the target group two, the contemplator. And, of course, the next slide just highlights what smokers will tell you about quitting, which is you can't force anybody to quit. You know, ex-smoker guns down, nagging wife, why? Because she forced him to quit. The next slide just points out what we all know. About two-thirds of smokers say they want to quit. In New York, because of our efforts here, about half of smokers make a quit attempt every year, but only about 1 in 5 of those are successful. If you go to the next slide, this is just showing you crude quit and relapse rates in a group of smokers that were followed over 17 years. And over time, the total quit rate actually is increasing. But on average, only about 3% of smokers actually quit. And, you know, you get about 1.5% every year of smokers who quit relapsing back to smoking. So the net change is very small. So the cigarette companies are working very hard to hold on to as many smokers as they can. So you go to the next smokers. Smokers tend to have an optimistic bias about quitting. The next slide just shows you that most smokers believe that they will quit smoking. In fact, if you ask smokers, do you think you will quit? 70% say they will. Quit in the next year, well, that's about a third. But if you ask, well, how about in the next 5 years, about half, over half of smokers say they'll quit in the next 5 years. The reality, as I showed you in those prior slides, is that most people, only about 3 out of 100, are quitting successfully in any given year. And if you go to the next slide, this belief about quitting sort of transcends the fact that people believe that they will avoid the health consequences from smoking because they're going to quit before they have any. About 60% told us that in a nationwide survey. These surveys are based on about 2,000 smokers. So if you go to the next slide, how do people quit? Well, most people try to quit without using stop smoking medications, which is unfortunate because we know that that will double a person's chances of success. If you go to the next slide, this is data from 2007 U.S. smokers. About a third of smokers who reported making a quit attempt in the last 12 months used a stop smoking medication. Most are using NRT. We see an increasing use of varenicline and a declining use of Zyban or bupropion. If you go to the next slide, why aren't smokers using the NRT? Well, it's marketed pretty lousily. You can only get it in drugstores where you can get cigarettes in your gas stations. It has a lot of negative attributes. Tastes lousy. It's slow delivery of nicotine. But a lot of smokers perceive access as a problem, and they have some concerns and misperceptions about how nicotine works. If you go to the next slide, this is just from a Wall Street Journal article that points out that many smokers are skeptical about the need and benefits of medications to help them quit. So the next slide just highlights the fact that most smokers believe what they've been told repeatedly by the tobacco companies, by the media. All you got to do is quit. 40 million Americans have quit smoking, so why can't you do it? So this is sort of a negative message for a lot of smokers who've tried to quit and just can't seem to get it done. So if you go to the next slide, here's my sort of summary. I think smokers have a misperception that gives them a general optimism about quitting. They think they can avoid health risks and will be able to quit easily, and that smokers have a misperception about the use of NRT, which they think actually is going to cause them more harm than good. NRT products like the patch and the gum are very safe. Marlboro patches and Skoal and Copenhagen, not so safe. So what the tobacco industry knew, if you go to the next slide, well, the cigarette companies have known for a long time. Philip Morris in 1972 said, no one has ever become a cigarette smoker by smoking cigarettes without nicotine. And as the next slide points out, this is from R.J. Reynolds, the cigarette company viewed themselves as a highly ritualized, stylized segment of the pharmaceutical industry. And as the next slide points out, they knew this was a big problem for them. And he said, what it sounds like is that the cigarette smoker is like a drug addict, which of course they are. If you go to the next slide. So why did they lie about it when they got up in front of Congress in 1994? Well, the reason they lied is indicated in this 1980 memo from the Tobacco Institute, which is we can't defend continued smoking as a free choice if the person is addicted. Since the vast majority of smokers are addicted, they can't defend smoking as free choice because it's not a free choice. Smoking is a constrained choice. So the next slide, you know, why are they still not telling the truth? You go to their website, this is for R.J. Reynolds, or Reynolds American, as they're now referred to, and this is what they say. Adults have the right to make informed choices about the risks they want to take, and, you know, who can argue with that? But they really don't have a choice when it comes to smoking, because most people get hooked as kids, and then they have a choice that's been highly constrained by how they design the product. So if you go to the next slide, that just really shows you the constrained choice. This is nicotina here. And if the cigarettes are designed to deliver nicotine, why don't we just take it out, as the next slide asks. Nicotine is the next slide show. This is what a tobacco plant looks like. The following slide shows you why they don't take it out, because it's all coming down to money. It costs about a nickel to make a package of cigarettes, about a quarter of a penny per stick, a highly profitable product. The industry shares their profits with a lot of people along the distribution line to keep them in line, including the politicians. If you go to the next slide, this just summarizes it's the product, not the smoker, that's the problem. And it helps to understand how cigarettes are designed to induce and maintain nicotine addiction. So the next slide just shows you some of the features of cigarette design. And it's not a simple, you know, bit of natural tobacco rolled in some paper with a filter stuck at the end. You've got casings and humigants and flavorants and pH controllers and things that control the burn temperature, which affects nicotine delivery. Flavoring agents, which also help to mask the harshness of the smoke, the packaging, the menthol, which is not a natural thing. It's an additive in the product. So if you go to the next slide, this summarizes that there is as much engineering in a cigarette as there is under the hood of your car, probably more if you ask me. If you go to the next slide, this just gives you the components of a typical U.S. blended cigarette. About 30 to 40% is flue-cured bright tobacco. U.S. cigarettes are different than the Canadian variety because the Canadian variety is almost all bright tobacco. U.S. cigarettes use burley tobacco, which has a higher nicotine content and is air-cured and also has higher levels of certain carcinogens, such as tobacco-specific nitrosamines, which are very potent lung carcinogens. You have stems, a little bit of oriental tobacco, and in most U.S. cigarettes today, we have this reconstituted tobacco, which makes up about 20 to 30% of the product. If you go to the next slide, this is just to illustrate if you take tobacco leaves and chop them in a piece of paper and roll them up in a piece of paper and stick it in your mouth, you're not going to get uniform nicotine delivery. You can't do it. The amount of nicotine varies from one part of the leaf to the next. Some leaves have virtually no nicotine. Others are loaded with it. So how do they control to get you the precise amount of nicotine in every cigarette? If you go to the next slide, well, one of the main ways they come about doing this, particularly as they've reduced the amount of tobacco to try to lower the illusion, give you the illusion you're getting less tar in the cigarettes, is to use more reconstituted or fake tobacco in the product. And if you want to know how much is real or Memorex in your cigarettes, a simple experiment. Just drop the tobacco in a glass of water. It will separate. The pieces that float on the surface are puffed up like the puffed rice tobacco, and also the recycled cigarettes or reconstituted tobacco. You can see the color of the water turns a little orange or yellowish in color, which is the coloring agents that come off the end. So about 30%, 20 to 30% of U.S. cigarettes today are fake tobacco. It's man-made material where they take the nicotine out and they spray it back onto the sheet of tobacco to control the nicotine that's there. There are also additives, as is indicated in the next slide, things like cadmium and arsenic and urea and ammonia that's added. So I always like to say a pea in every puff, because they add urea to control the pH level of the smoke, which has an effect on how mild the smoke feels, as well as the speed of nicotine delivery to the brain. You've got things like additives, and the cigarette companies test their additives. They take them from the GRAS list, which is generally regarded as safe by the federal government, except the National Toxicology GRAS list really is based on the assumption that you eat the additive, you don't burn it. So these are some of the additives that are actually added. There are over 600 that are on the additive list for cigarettes. And when you burn many of these additives, they are highly carcinogenic. In fact, back in 1963, as you can go to the next slide, this is actually an internal Philip Morris document that acknowledges that the application of the GRAS list for additives. And the company always says, well, our additives have all been tested and shown to be safe. Well, this is baloney. They knew that they are dangerous when you burn them. They actually create different risks. And things like chocolate, which is often added to cigarettes, sounds okay, except when you burn chocolate, actually acts as a bronchodilator. You go to the next slide. Probably the biggest problem with cigarettes today is their use of pH enhancers like ammonia or ammoniation. It reduces irritation. Philip Morris was the first to use diammonia phosphate in their product, or DAP, to alter a blend chemistry. It's the reason that Marlboro cigarettes became the leading selling brand of cigarettes. They started this first. And the advantage of adding ammonia, as the company figured out, was that it altered the pH. It allowed the release of free nicotine, getting the nicotine effect to the brain a little bit faster, like freebasing. And there are a variety of other chemicals that are now utilized in making cigarettes, but ammonia worked quite well. They have various patents, as is shown in the next slide, and the use of bandcast, ammoniated bandcast, is predominant in all the cigarette companies, but particularly Marlboro and Philip Morris brands. Go to the next slide. This is just giving you the issues around ammoniation. I won't go into the delivery because I've covered those already. I'm going to move right now just to the very end of my slides, because I'd like to leave a little bit of time for questions. You've got the slides there, and there's a lot to cover on youth marketing and how they design cigarettes for youth. But if you go to the bottom line, what's next kind of thing, you've got some new products here, such as the smokeless cigarettes. Marlboro Snus has been introduced in parts of the country. You've got Camel Snus. And now, most recently, Reynolds will be introducing around spring break for our college campuses, Sticks, Orbs, and Strips. These are smokeless, dissolvable products and probably are designed primarily to address young people as a bridge product where they can't smoke, such as a bar, and so they will use both the cigarettes and these other products, and in fact, there's dual marketing of these with Camel cigarettes. The next slide just shows you the website, tobaccoproducts.org, where you can learn more about these. So a few take-home points, just to finish up. I think you need to ask your patients what brand they're smoking and why. You need to correct misperceptions about tobacco products and stop smoking medications, because I think you can assume that misperceptions are the norm. Filters are not better, lights do not have less nicotine, and they're not easier to quit, although many smokers believe that. Natural is not safer. The so-called additive-free cigarettes have plenty of additives. They've got paper, they've got ink, they've got filters and filter fibers. Those are not natural to the cigarettes. And there are a lot of other gimmicks, by the way. There's a lot of pesticides in those products. They're not organically grown, as might be assumed under the marketing. Secondly, I think you've got to address the fear that people have of nicotine. Nicotine does not cause cancer. It is, however, the thing that keeps people smoking. So the fear of nicotine is a barrier keeping many patients from using nicotine replacement products. So it helps to educate. There are some great websites. If you go to the next slide, just I'll refer you to mysmokefree.com. You can learn a lot more about what's in a cigarette there. The next website, doingyoudamage.com, gives you some of the examples of advertisements that we've utilized. Feel free to take any of these or contact me afterwards, and I'd be happy to assist you in how to download and utilize or adapt these for your own use. The next slide just shows you some examples of ads that we created and ran in one of our newspapers up here fairly inexpensively. We did it with one of the restaurant throwaway papers, running a series of ads over a couple of months, like the fraud ad that I had shown before. If you go to the next slide, what's coming, the Department of Justice lawsuit, eventually they're going to get that all handled, and I believe the cigarette companies will have to run corrective statements. This is an example of a corrective statement ad that we've actually been testing in advance of that appeal coming to an end. And so this would be like a reverse of the original Frank statement and would require the cigarette companies to run ads like this one. Philip Morris USA manipulated cigarettes by adding things like ammonia to make them more addictive. Let's hope that these kinds of things are available. And there's some handouts that are also at the end of my slide presentation. But I will end there and open it up for questions. I know we only have a little bit of time left, but I'd like to be able to take a few questions. So if the operator could come on and explain that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Most definitely. If you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Our first question comes from Robin. Robin, your line is open.
Thank you.
Hi, Robin.
This was really very eye-opening, and I thank you very much for all this rich information. I called in a little late, and you may have covered this in the beginning. I'm just wondering about consumer advocacy groups and how isn't this, you know, very specific, rich information distributed to the general population so they can be aware, more aware of what they're really putting into their bodies?
I agree completely that we've done a poor job of educating both ourselves about cigarette design and how it influences smoking, and then, of course, translating that information so consumers can get it. The industry doesn't like this information getting out, and as you can imagine, in Massachusetts and in New York State, when I think we ran a few years ago a ad on light cigarettes, I think the analogy was the filter vents and the vacuum ad. Some of you might remember that ran for a bit. And some nasty letters were sent to our friends in the Department of Health. I think the Quitline, because our number was advertised on those ads, also received a nasty letter. This industry is very sensitive about it, and we should not back down. We need to get this information out. It's one of the reasons we're doing this. Happy to share our materials, but we got a long way to go. The surveys that I've done of consumers indicate that people are really misinformed about the products they're using, how the companies have manipulated to keep people addicted and hooked. And let's hope that regulation of the product will be one of the ways that the FDA will be required perhaps to educate the public, because they've got a big hill to climb in this regard.
Right.
But I agree with you that we have to do a lot more. There are some websites that I've given you some information on. Haven't gone into half of what I could share with you.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things coming out. There's going to be a monograph from NCI on cigarette products and some of the regulations around the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, or FCTC. And other countries have, I think, done a better job of actually educating consumers about tobacco products, but we have a long way to go.
Right. Thank you.
Okay,
our next question comes from Max. Max, your line is open.
Hello.
Hi, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm sorry. I just had a quick question. I wanted to clarify something. So are you saying that actually light cigarettes are more harmful than regular cigarettes?
I did say that.
Okay.
So more harmful is sort of a relative thing. I can tell you that on the basis of an Ames test, when you look at vented cigarettes, so the more ventilation you get, the higher scores you get on an Ames assay, which is measuring DNA breaks. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, more lung cancers, more heart disease. But I can tell you that there has been a shift over the last 50 years. I work at a cancer center. The predominant form of lung cancer we used to see, particularly among men, was squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. That's a lung cancer that tends to occur mainly in the central part of the airway, where the initial breaks in the airway to the left and the right lung occur. Adenocarcinoma is the predominant form of lung cancer we see today, and adenocarcinoma tends to occur more peripherally in the outer reaches of the lung. Turns out it's harder to treat. They're both deadly, by the way. But here's the deal. When we had unfiltered cigarettes, big blobs of tar got stuck in the upper reaches of the lung, but couldn't get down as deeply into the deeper regions. When you switch to a filter, and then you put vent holes, making it easier for people to take a draw on a cigarette, what we see is smokers take bigger, deeper draws off of the cigarettes, and smaller, finer particles go deep into the lung. This is one of the reasons we've seen that shift, in my opinion. There's some other changes to the cigarettes, such as the use of burley tobacco, which may also have contributed. So in my regard, it's clear that light cigarettes are and filtered cigarettes are no better than the ones they replaced prior to 1950. And I think that's pretty startling for a lot of people.
Okay. Thank you very much for answering that.
Okay, sure.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, we have a question from Peter Taylor. Peter, your line is open.
Yes, Dr. Cummings, I was wondering what you feel the new President-elect Obama, what his view on legislation, especially since he's a smoker himself.
Well, what was stated yesterday in the New York Times article is the administration is seriously thinking about raising the cigarette tax, and that they're supportive. And President-elect Obama was Senator Obama, he was a sponsor of the FDA bill. So all I can say is I think tobacco is on the agenda, and you're likely to see, particularly since there was a pretty large support for using the federal cigarette tax to fund the SCHIP bill, the Children's Health Insurance Bill, which sunsets in March. So Congress is going to have to reconsider that because they've got to come up with a way to pay for the health insurance for poor children. That's likely to come up right away. And the word on the street is that FDA regulation is probably coming, I would expect it by May of this year. And so I think that's very positive. Carl Rove used to be a lobbyist for Philip Morris back when he was in Texas before he came to Washington. And so we all know the story of what the Bush administration has thought about tobacco, although the good news is apparently Laura Bush finally quit smoking, and maybe President-elect Obama will do so as well.
Thank you.
Yep.
I think, Dr. Cummings, we have time for just one more question.
Sure.
Okay. Our last question comes from David. David, your line is open.
My question is it smoking itself? Is that the issue? The delivery system is the problem? Because nicotine patches are not harmful? Is that the way I should understand that?
Well, the delivery system is harmful, and the cigarette is inherently, or any combustion product that delivers nicotine, is inherently defective because the pulmonary delivery of nicotine is what gets people easily addicted to the product, and which reinforces repetitive use. I don't think we'd have a problem if somebody were smoking one or two cigarettes. The problem is we have people who are smoking 20 cigarettes a day, 365 days a year for 40 years. And that's where you see the, you know, dramatic increase in risk. Nicotine patches or any oral delivery of nicotine is a lot less dangerous. Now, the patch just gives you nicotine in the glue. Gum gives you some buffers in the nicotine. When you go to smokeless tobacco products, you get a lot of other stuff, And I think we need to do a lot more research on the emissions that people get from smokeless tobacco, because there's some smokeless tobacco products that look not very much different than a nicotine lozenge, and there are others that are pretty dirty. Copenhagen would be in the dirty category of U.S. smokeless products because of high carcinogen levels that are found just naturally in the cured tobacco they use, just as an example.
I see.
So combustion, delivery system, big problem. If you're smoking nicotine-free cigarettes, they're not going to be safe, but chances are you won't continue to use them, and that's what we have found. So take the nicotine out of combustion tobacco products.
Okay, Dr. Cummings, I want to thank you very much for your presentation today, and on behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and the New York State Smokers Quitline, we want to thank all of you for tuning in today to this outstanding presentation. And if you please will mark your calendars, our next conference call will be on March 4th, 2009, and the topic will be treating tobacco use and dependence with pregnant women, and we'll give you updated information on the new Medicaid counseling benefit. And this will bring us to a close to today's call. Thank you to everyone, and to all of you, have a happy new year.